Welcome to the Living Dice Podcast. Today's episode, Gaming Through the Ages. Hello, this is Trent with my cohort Stuart. Hello, Stuart.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to Living Dice Podcast. I may have been a bit deceptive there at the beginning when I said it was gaming through the ages. In fact, it is a relatively short age. That is our age. So today we're going to be talking about how we developed as gamers. Now, before you hang up on me, there is some potential here because Stuart and I are both likely older than whoever's listening to this, because statistically most gamers are younger than we are. So our development might be a little different from the people who just instantly dropped into the middle of a fully developed and, in fact, socially acceptable gaming culture. And with that, I'll start with Stuart, and he can kind of kick us off. And I believe you're going to start back in the 80s, Stu?
Yeah, we're going to start back in the 80s with our very first gaming experiences. And, you know, what you said, Trent, was actually resonates a lot about, you know, the gamers now and not having fully formed games and whatnot, because, you know, way back when I actually had the D&D Dungeons and Dragons red box, and I had gotten this thing at, I think at a yard sale, but it wasn't that old because it probably had only been out, I don't know, 3-4 years or so. And
so year are we talking here?
Early 80s.
Okay.
But I was infatuated by this dragon and all these warriors on the cover and these weird shaped dice that I had to get this thing. And I didn't know what this thing was, but I got it and I read it and I realized that I can't do anything with it because, one, I didn't know what the heck I was supposed to do with it. And two, I didn't have anyone that I was supposed to do it with. So it was completely lost on me. And unfortunately, the game itself has been lost through the annals of time because I don't know whatever happened to it, although I do still have the dice. But I did get my first gaming experience, although it was a bad one, with the D&D red box.
So I too, I can actually date mine pretty specifically because I remember playing during Resource, a kid threw together a D&D game. He was slightly older than I was. I was 13 and he was a little older than me, almost 14. It was seventh grade-ish, maybe sixth grade. So I was 12, 13 at the time. He actually ran a little scenario involving us breaking into a temple and fighting some orcs, I believe. And I was hooked, sold instantly. This is for me. My parents, my mother specifically, and this is ironic, is a huge garage sale fiend. So I too got my first gaming book from a garage sale, except I went in full both feet. She bought me the AD&D manual with the red ifrit on the front.
Mm.
I never had any red box. I started with AD&D and that hurt. I didn't realize at the time, but I should have totally done the red box and started out basic. But I went in, read the book. Book was amazing. And exactly like you, I had no way to implement it. I didn't have the background, the experience, exposure. Let's try exposure to use it, to implement it, because I had no real demo. The little one shot that the kid named Damon ran for me, I'll never forget his name. It was very fun, but it didn't have any development, didn't have any story, and was simply a function of me being a kid. I think if I had an adult who had played or who was a grognard, which we may touch on a bit later, I think I would have made better use of it. But as it was, I didn't play like a real game for a couple of years, I think, much closer to eighth grade. And then freshman high school, I started playing more aggressively, poorly, mind you, but playing.
Yeah, well, we'll touch around high school in a second, but you know, after my horrible experience with the red blocks, and I'd say horrible, it's just, it wasn't really horrible. It was just kind of sad and depressing because it looked so cool and I had no idea what to do. But I remember vividly when I was about 13. It would have been in junior high school. I was walking through a toy section of a store. I can't remember the store, but I was walking through the toy section and the game section, and I saw this huge box labeled Hero Quest. And it had this huge barbarian on the cover and all these skeletons and orcs and stuff in the background. And I had to have that game. And I don't remember what I had to do to get it, but I remember it being a hard-fought negotiation with my parents, because this wasn't a yard sale. This was a brand new game. And I was victorious. And I got this game. I was old enough at that point. The rules were pretty easy. And I got together some friends and we actually played. Now, if you're not familiar with Hero Quest, it's a board game with very, very light role-playing mixed in. It was an absolutely fantastic gateway game. And one of my cherished prizes from my childhood, one of the very few things that I've kept. In fact, over the years, I've bought other versions to have extra parts to it. And maybe in a future show, I can go into detail about my love of Hero Quest. But that was really the key that started me down the path to all of the gaming that I've done since.
So my diverged a little. I started playing some AD&D, some first edition D&D, some of the early first edition modules. It was all garage sale material. Like, I still have first editions of most of the Slaver series, the Assault on the Area of the Slave Lords, the Hidden Shrine of Tamil Cham. Best one for me, though, was B2 Horror on the Hill. I thought that was the best module ever. And to date, as a dungeon crawl, I still think it's aces. Full on, crawling through a dungeon, killing stuff. It was great fun. We had a good time with that. But that got me through until I hit high school and I fell into a group of ill repute. And they actually introduced me to some different games. Now, for those of you that are younger, there's a break point in the 70s and 80s where board games fell into two categories. Affectionately, Ameritrash, isn't that the term, Stu, for things like Monopoly and Payday and the Game of Life, the stuff that Milton Bradley put out that is just basically unplayable now.
Yeah, yes.
And then there was the Grognards. The term is pejorative, but the fact is it's still applicable. It's basically really, really nerdy guys who push little cardboard chips around a table, like the Guns of August, where you have hundreds of these little cardboard chips and it takes hundreds of hours to complete a game. Somewhere in between, they started putting out some what would be today called Euro-style games that made it onto real store shelves. And the one that struck me was a game called Kingmaker, which actually was a British game, but it came out in Milton Bradley late 70s, early 80s. And it could arguably be the first Euro-style game I ever played, because rather than some dice rolling in chaos like Risk, it actually had mechanics for acquiring abilities and voting. Like, you'd go to locations and vote on who would be the next king of England, and there'd be random plagues, which was good fun. And that really set a standard for me in terms of gaming. And immediately thereafter, I reached the epitome of board gaming, in my opinion, the one which has no equal. Stu, what is my favorite all-time board game?
Diplomacy.
Indeed. After you play Diplomacy, everything else is second best. Now, it could be said there's some other options out there, but that's just how, the minute I hit Diplomacy, I was off to the races. I was a gamer for life at that point. Board games and RPGs. I guess I've diverged a bit into high school era, I suppose.
Yeah. No, that's, yeah. So in high school, it's interesting. So it's like, I kind of, you know, got my chops with Hero Quest, which was very much a board game. When I got into high school, I kind of veered off and really got into the role-playing games. And my very first game was in high school. I finally had the mental wherewithal to understand all these crazy rules. I had some people to actually play with, and we kicked off an adventure of using the AD&D system, Oriental Adventures. And if for no reason other than that was what we found in our school library. And it's amazing that we even had one in the school library, but it was there.
Wait a minute, you had Oriental Adventures in your school library?
Yeah, and it was the only book, and I'm guessing they probably didn't realize that it was a Dungeons and Dragons book just because it looked so, you know, different.
Asian.
Yeah, although it said, I mean, it has Dungeons and Dragons plastered across the top, but it was there and literally the only role-playing book in the entire library. So my friends and I would take turns, like, checking it out. Like, one would bring it back and the other one would be waiting to check it out. So, you know, sorry for everyone who else was in high school with us and never got a chance to check out the Oriental Adventures. But we played that for at lunchtime for a good year.
So high school for me, besides discovering Euro-style board games, which I played a variety of, I won't go into horrifying detail here. We're trying to be a bit more generic. But it was at this point that I discovered that Dragon Magazine, which, so I know this is going to date us, but Stu and I were drawing breath in gaming before the internet.
Yes.
You young whippersnappers that have internet have no concept as to how hard gaming was without this army of instantly available knowledge givers.
Oh, yeah.
Floating around. You had to just figure it out for yourself. And there were gaming groups, but I don't know about Stu, but I grew up in this podunk little town in California. It was awful. No game store. Concept didn't even exist. You had a few kind of nerdy people who kind of got it. But in retrospect, only a couple of us were truly gamers. The rest of them were just kind of hanging out.
Yeah. You know, I mean, mine was mostly in the Phoenix area, and it's the birthplace of several of the old RPGs. And I'm sure that community was thriving. It just, like you said, there was no internet or no way to connect unless you knew someone. I had no idea this stuff exists. I mean, I got all my gaming stuff from the old War Games West catalog. You remember that thing?
I do. I remember War Games West. I remember White Dwarf, which was another, and of course, Dragon Magazine, which was the be all end all for me, because I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was sort of catch-all. I remember specifically by the time I got my driver's license when I was 16 or 17, I had to drive, and this is a true story, 80 miles one way to get to this pathetic little town called Eureka, California. And they had a hobby shop that had a game section, legitimate game section. It was there I discovered that people besides TSR made games. And started piling up. I had Gamma World, Rifts, Palladium in 17 different flavors, Robotech, all the good late 80s. So I graduated in 1990. So late 80s, early 90s, there was a sort of D&D was still king. And second edition came out sometime around 90, 91, something like that. Does that sound right? 89?
Yeah.
Somewhere in there. So it was kind of a big deal. I attended at this time when I was 19. I attended my first gaming convention, which I sadly cannot remember the name of. Oh, I can remember the name, but I'm sorry. ArcadaCon at Humboldt State University in 1989.
All right. Well, it's funny you mentioned Robotech, because that's kind of the tail end of my high school years. That Robotech and a pack of polyhedral dice and some knives were the first purchase that I made from War Games West. And of course, you know, you had to sit there and wait a few weeks for the package to show up. But, you know, we just picked it out of this catalog, and it had a picture. It's like giant robots. That looks cool. And the little thing, and very inexperienced gamers dropped with a Palladium book. It was a mess. We tried, but it just did not work. And, you know, that kind of went through the end of high school. At that point, video games were really coming in, especially all those D&D games. Eye of the Beholder is my favorite. So at that time, I kind of started getting lost away from tabletop gaming into the video game world, and didn't come back until college.
So college is interesting, for me because I have to admit I took a hiatus for several years. My university provided far too many distractions for me to game. I knew there were gamers. And in fact, I remember specifically going to a game group meeting once when I was probably a junior at my university, which, by the way, was a big university. There's a lot of students. It's California school, so it was huge. And it seemed, even by my standards today, it seemed particularly nerdy to the point that I, at the time, I'm just like, you know, this probably isn't for me, which is the strangest thing I've ever said about gaming. But they were way off in left field. I mean, way off in left field. So blew that off, traveled, wound up playing, and this is no joke, Night Spawn, which I refuse to call it Nightbane from Palladium just because they got sued. One of my all-time favorite Palladium games. Again, Palladium has its issues, but I thought the world was really cool. I wound up playing that at the Virtual World Arcade in Leicester Square in London. I was living over there for a year with a bunch of the pilots who flew in the Alpha Pods for the Battletech simulator they had. And we would play Battletech at night with the bar, and then after that we'd hang out in their back room playing RPGs. And that's kind of when I got back into it.
Yeah, so it was Magic the Gathering that actually brought me back into tabletop gaming. And I could have mentioned this back in my first games because I had a time when I was before high school. So this probably would have been junior high when I had cousins coming to visit me and they had this game called Magic the Gathering and we played it. And it's like, wow, this is fun. And then I had my dad drive me to the hobby shop and picked up a couple packs so I could play them. And they were there visiting us for like a week and we played the heck out of that game and then they left and then I don't know whatever happened to those cards. But then in college, met up with this group that was, it was, you know, this, that was before Magic was big. And then when college, it started getting big and started playing again. It's like, hey, I know this game. I wish I had all those old cards, which would then be super rare and expensive, but yeah, I got into the card game and spent lots of time and lots of money just the printed, what is it called? Card crack or whatever.
Cardboard
crack. Yeah. But it brought me in. It brought me into the game shop. That's where I first learned like, hey, there's game shops, you know, it brought me into the crowd. And then it was easy to make those transitions. I went, you know, checked out board games. That was my first experience with Euro games through Catan, though back then it was Settlers of Catan. And buddies and I would play the heck out of that game. And then I got back into AD&D. And that's actually where I met you, Trent, for the second time. The first time we actually worked together, but never really commingled. But then a mutual friend brought me to an AD&D game and you were there and magic bloomed.
Yeah. It was a bromance. No, it's just someday we'll do a show about that. There's something to be said by the people you surround yourself with when you game, which is probably a show unto itself. But there's a certain magic there. We'll go into that some other time, but bottom line is, I had traveled extensively and I got back to Arizona. I moved to Arizona, which is where we're based out of, 20 years ago, 19 years ago, excuse me, 19 years ago. And I came back and I noticed there were a couple game stores. I remember trundling down there and I wasn't even married at the time. So shows how old I am. And they started playing one of my all-time favorite board games. It has raging playability problems, but Supremacy was a great game. I remember playing in high school, so these guys didn't know how to play. I helped them play. And after that, it was Euro games all day, every day. I'm not even sure how I wound up playing. You know what? I do remember now. At one point, there was a small convention for, I don't remember the name of the convention here in the Phoenix Valley area, but they were playing Living City. Do you remember Living City, Stu?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was Raven's something, Raven's Bluff. And it was one of the first Living campaigns, which is a separate show unto itself. And I remember going there and seeing these guys playing this hardcore, and they were deadly serious about it. And I had no clue what they were doing. So finally kind of got into some of the living games, and that sort of kicked off me attending conventions and playing a lot more Euro games and a lot more RPGs. And again, that's how we met. But then, which I guess is a good segue, because you have an item here about the dawn of organized play.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Living City. I've heard of it. I never played it. And then you had like Living Greyhawk, which started, and I never really played that either. But, and I don't even know how, who drug me into it, but we started playing Living Arcanus. And that was where really my love of role-playing games kind of shifted to from, you know, just kind of get together and not take it seriously to really getting into it and really loving the craft. Started learning how to play, started learning how to GM. And the good thing about organized play for me was that you played with lots of different players and lots of different GMs and lots of different styles. So while it was the same game, it, you know, it really helped expand my mental capacity of how to be a good GM. At least I hope I'm a good GM. I think I am. And, you know, it was that Living Arcanus was an especially a special game in that it wasn't the save the princess, meet in the tavern kind of game. And they did not have qualms. And we talked about in the previous show about putting in those kind of moral Sophie's Choice kind of situations where you would quite often have the players arguing amongst themselves on what to do. You know, in a traditional role-playing game, that doesn't happen a lot. Your goal is usually pretty clear. You're going and slaying the bad guys and, you know, finding the treasure or whatever. But this was, it was a well-done game, in my opinion, and it really helped form me to the game that I am today.
I agree. I completely agree. I too found Living Arcanus, not a breath of fresh air. That's not the right term. A more professional approach, I suppose. The way Living Arcanus worked is many of the modules and adventures were written by volunteers, but there was a core set of stories written by basically one author for Paradigm Concepts, which was Mr. Lopez.
Henry Lopez. He wrote all most of the core ones. Yeah.
The core ones. And he actually had an idea of, again, moral quandaries. He had ongoing plots that were not blatantly obvious. Like NPCs you met in some adventure that were just kind of there later on would appear and they mattered. And your interactions with them previously mattered. It wasn't a perfect experience. I think Paradigm dropped the ball towards the end of the campaign. And there was too much focus on the rules and it got ridiculous. Someday I'll post pictures. I still have all my Arcanus like character sheets and stuff you needed to play. It was incredibly complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, I didn't care for the system that much. It was in D&D 3.5 and it, at high levels, it is just a very, very complex game. So it got, towards the end, it did get a little tiring. It got a little crazy. And then they had a, you know, this, it was the, when the big shift was going over from third edition to fourth edition in D&D, and there were some issues and yeah, unfortunately the game kind of petered out. Now it is reborn and it's living again. But I've had minimal exposure with it since
We would regularly fly to the Origins Game Fair, which I believe is this weekend, if I'm not mistaken, to play in the special events because Paradigm Concepts always ran the big events at Origins instead of Gen Con. That said, overall, Living Arcanus really pulled me into the development side of it. It's one of the impetuses for me creating livingdice.com, Living Arcanus, you know, Living Dice. That was the inspiration for it. But more importantly, we were Invisible Kings. Stu, you want to talk about that a bit? Because I think that's interesting that we did that.
Yeah, towards the end, as you mentioned, it was heavily volunteer driven. And towards the end, they had this special program where they, you know, they had these groups who wanted to pair up called Invisible Kings to help push adventures out for their system. And, you know, it was something just to get more stuff out there, I guess, kind of quickly. And it was a bunch of different kind of smaller storylines while their main development team focused on the overall core storyline.
Yeah, so interested groups of volunteers, say if 3 to 5 people would apply, and they'd be granted like a small named city within the world, but one that wasn't, we basically weren't allowed to touch the core story, but we could do a lot within our little vicinity. Ours was Madake. We put out a few modules before the program sort of crashed and burned for a variety of reasons, but I wrote my first module for that. I wrote several of those. That was a great experience. I really got deep into the story part of it. It really pushed me to be a better gamer at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing Arcanist did for us, it got us going to the big shows, you know, got us going to the conventions.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that really, you know, that takes us to where we are in current day. So during those years, you know, we would go to Origins to play Living Arcanus. Now we go to Gen Con to play everything that's not nailed down, right? I mean, every year we're trying to find the new stuff to play. And we had a couple shows back, if you want to go listen to it, about what we're going to play at Gen Con this current year. It's a bunch of different stuff just so we could get exposures to new games, you know. And for me personally, after leaving Living Arcanus and third edition, you know, our home group, we tried fourth edition and stuff. But as I grew as a GM, I really, I guess I got, I know what I like and I know what I don't like. And I really gravitate towards games that focus on storytelling and less number crunching. So, you know, we started off with, we tried the Dragon Age, which is the age system from Green Ronin. And that was great. That was a great progression. And then, you know, as we mentioned in other shows, we got hooked into Numenera and the Cypher system. And that's kind of currently where my sweet spot is right now, because it's the kind of game that I like, with a mixture of rules and story and how to GM the game and stuff like that.
Well, Stu is selling us a bit short. In between there, that wasn't quite a clean transition. There were some interlopers that we will name, and I will tell you up front that if you play these things, do it with a gigantic grain of salt stuck in your mouth, because there's some raging problems. Cowboys and Indians, which is Aces and Eights.
Aces and Eights. It's a great system, but it's a lot of work.
It is. For the GM, it's just too much work. I like the world, the alternate West, but not sci-fi alternate, just slightly alternate. Like the Native American population has their own country, and there's like wars between the North and South and the Native population. Very interesting world. Mechanically, it's painful.
They do have one of the best mechanics in that shot clock kind of thing.
Which we may cover in a later show on gun mechanics, but... Yeah. In fact, we definitely will. That's a great idea. The other one for me is Alpha Omega, which if you ever want to look it up, the game is extinct. Mindstorm Labs is out of business. If you can find a copy, it's worth reading through for the background story. For all that is holy, please do not play the system that comes with it. Because once I had exhausted the monsters in the monster manual that it came with it, the game is unplayable. It's so mechanically complicated. It makes D&D 3.5 look like Amber Diceless.
Yeah, it was a lot. Then there were some games we got that we couldn't even bring to the table. Like, what's that one very beautiful game that you bought one year at Gen Con?
Oh, there's a couple of those. Shadows Over Esterin, which is, I can't say too many, well, I bought, it's this European book. It's beautiful. It has amazing art. It's an import. I read through it and I couldn't bring myself to even inflict it on my players. I just didn't like it. It wasn't my thing. Numero uno, though, on my list is Eorus.
Yes, yes.
And Eorus, which I, by the way, still have a couple copies of, is a sort of postmodern, if I can even use that term, yoga-influenced crystal hug-thy-neighbor sort of role-playing game, but it has amazing artwork. I mean, it's literally the most beautiful RPG book I've ever seen. and it came and flamed out 5-8 years ago now. But yeah, these all floated across the table before we landed on our current setup.
Yeah. Yeah. So that kind of brings us where we're at now. We're, you know, always trying new things, and I don't know. It's, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll find something that, that dethrones the Cypher system.
Well, it's technically, it's technically related, but the one thing I do want to throw out there is I just was notified today that Invisible Sun is in the warehouse.
Yes. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Monty Cook Monster RPG Kickstarter is going to be available for our inspection within the next 2 weeks, I should expect. I hope. And yeah, that's probably going to be our next evolution at that point. And that game, frankly, sells itself as a financial issues aside, it sells itself as high thought. I don't want to say it's biased towards intelligent people. That's not the right term I'm looking for. They are aspiring to a higher level of gaming. Let's go with that. Now, whether or not we get there, who knows, but that's what they're selling it as. So I'm really excited to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we'll check that out. I'm interested in the digital component there too. I think, you know, speaking of evolution, looking towards the future, I think the next big thing that I would want to gravitate towards is some company that gets the digital component right. Something that I can, you know, I can bring my tablet to the table with all my character information and the books and everything. And it's not just PDFs, you know, it's some sort of interactive thing where it's technology driven for the data, but we're still sitting at the table doing the same old roll the dice.
I agree.
Talk to another person.
I think that's the iteration as well, because Invisible Sun does have an app with it to help make it a little smoother. I own a game called Weave that I picked up at Gen Con last year that has an app that's mandatory. You have to use it with these, and you have to scan tarot cards to generate the game. Wasn't my favorite game. I'll talk about that on another show, but it is definitely one of the most ambitious in terms of app integration. And to be clear, what Stu's talking about isn't, he's right, it's not just PDFs. It's the app or piece of software is the game, but it isn't playable. I mean, there's no like sword swinging barbarians on your pad. It's still a traditional RPG sort of experience, but it's trackable as your characters and events and whatnot are trackable in the software. There's been some attempts, but frankly, I don't think anybody's really pulled it off very well.
No. So,
but
yeah, so that's where we're at now.
Indeed. I hope we haven't bored you too terribly with our tales of, you know, early 80s gaming. But I think it might be interesting, especially, as I said, for younger folks to know what it was like before you had things like the internet or children's RPGs. I don't know about you, Stu, but I didn't even know they existed. But apparently they're a new thing, and they're like Monty Cook has No Thank You Evil. Does very well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is probably another show, but just at a very high level. I mean, it's something new. There have been hits and misses along the way, but it's just really starting to take root. And I mean, No Thank You Evil, I had my now 6-year-old, he was 5 at the time, playing a role playing game, which, I mean, like I said, when I was 10, I had the D&D box, and I didn't know what to do with it. It's just come so, the hobby itself has come so far.
Right. And we might actually do a show just on that as well. But in the meantime, we don't want to bore you too terribly. We're running a bit long. So Stu, what show number is this?
Show number 8.
Indeed, it is show number 8. So when it goes online, you can see the show notes, and I'll post some of the links to the games we talk about. It's livingdice.com/8, and that'll take you right to the show notes. If you would, please, if you could subscribe to us on iTunes or your favorite platform, it'd be much appreciated. Or use the contact form on the site and send us some love notes or maybe hate mail. We read it all. So anyway, we're out of here. We'll talk to you next time. See you later.
All right.